KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Arbitrary and capricious. That's how critics describe many of President Trump's executive orders aimed at the federal workforce. We'll take a look at some of the laws they cite on Morning Edition from NPR News. The quest to expand America's control over lands far from U.S. borders is raising questions and concerns. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Ian Martinez. We go to Copenhagen, where officials are baffled about Trump's claims that he wants to take over Greenland. Also, researchers may have figured out how to grow teeth for humans in pigs' mouths. Yeah, you heard me right. And we have a story behind an open-source battle map of the Ukraine-Russia war that's always shifting. It's Monday, February 10th. Actress and activist Laura Dern is 58 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Today, a federal judge in Boston will consider whether to keep the pause on the Trump administration's deferred resignation offer to federal employees. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports labor unions have sued to block it, calling the deal unlawful.
The Trump administration has presented federal workers a choice: remain in your jobs but risk getting laid off, or agree to resign now and keep your pay and benefits through the end of September. Unions have argued that the deal violates a law that prohibits agencies from obligating funds that Congress hasn't approved. They also accuse the Trump administration of failing to consider potential adverse consequences should large swaths of the federal workforce resign. Attorneys general from 20 states and D.C. filed a brief in support of the unions, warning that the resignation offer, quote, would have a devastating impact on states' abilities to respond to natural disasters, support veterans, and deliver crucial services to millions of Americans. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This morning, a third federal judge has now blocked President Trump's executive action ending birthright citizenship for people born in the U.S. to parents who are here illegally. The ruling came from a judge in New Hampshire in a lawsuit filed by the ACLU. The group alleges Trump's action tries to overturn one of the most fundamental American constitutional values. Stocks opened higher this morning as President Trump threatens new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 150 points in early trading.
President Trump says he plans to announce a 25% tax on all imported steel and aluminum, extending a trade battle he launched during his first term in the White House. The move has the potential to boost domestic steel and aluminum makers while also raising costs for businesses and consumers that buy steel and aluminum, ranging from automakers to soda pop and beer drinkers. The Golden Arches lost some of their shine in the most recent quarter. McDonald's saw its U.S. sales fall, partly as a result of an E. coli outbreak, which briefly took quarter pounders off the menu in some states. President Trump says he's directed the Treasury Department to stop minting new pennies. The government's been losing money on the coins, which each cost more than a penny to make. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is doubling down on his claim the U.S. is going to seize the wrecked enclave of Gaza, home to Palestinians displaced by the war between Israel and Hamas.
Think of it as a big real estate site, and the United States is going to own it and will slowly, very slowly, we're in no rush, develop it. We're going to bring stability to the Middle East.
But there are few supporters of Trump's views in other countries. Egypt announced over the weekend it will host an emergency Arab summit on February 27th. Egypt says this is to discuss, quote, new and dangerous developments. You're listening to NPR. President Trump says he will dismiss what's known as the boards of visitors to U.S. military academies. Writing online this morning, Trump claims they are infiltrated by, quote, woke leftist ideologues. He offered no evidence. The boards are outside advisory groups that offer advice to the Naval Academy, for example. But some members of these visitors' boards are appointed by Congress, not by the president. Scientists at universities across the country are warning new federal funding cuts to current and future research could endanger human health. From member station KQED, Sarah Hosseini reports the funding cuts announced by the National Institutes of Health take effect today.
The NIH says it's capping money for facilities and administrative costs at 15% to align with the amount some private funders permit. Stanford University professor Benjamin Good says the future of his research on the gut microbiome is now in jeopardy without money for secure data storage, janitorial services, and chemical safety training, among many other functions.
The science we do, I think it's extremely important. It's very basic science, and it's not something that companies support right now.
In a statement, Stanford says cuts to research on its campus will amount to $160 million per year. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hosseini.
Writer Tom Robbins has died at his home in Washington State, according to a friend. He was 92 years old. Robbins dazzled millions of readers with novels such as Jitterbug Perfume and even Cowgirls Get the Blues. No funeral details for Robbins have been announced. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, as the president moves to make quick and far-reaching changes to the federal government, we take a look at some of the laws that critics say Trump is bypassing or violating. But first,
Israel and Hamas are maintaining a fragile ceasefire in Gaza.
That has allowed more food and medicine to enter the Palestinian territory that's been devastated by more than a year of war. It's still not enough, according to aid officials. Jordan has begun helping out, delivering medical supplies via what it refers to as an air bridge, flying helicopters to land inside Gaza.
NPR's Jane Araf went on a recent flight. She joins us from Amman. Jane, so Jordan has carried out a lot of aid airdrops throughout the war in Gaza. What's different about these latest efforts?
Well, those were part of multinational efforts that dropped aid from the air on pallets with parachutes. Some of them ended up in the sea, and there was always the danger of those heavy pallets landing on people. So these flights, 16 a day over 18 days, have actually landed in Gaza, although on the outskirts, which makes the aid much more targeted.
Okay, now tell us about the flight you took. I mean, what were the aircrafts carrying?
They were Black Hawk helicopters, and they were loaded with cardboard boxes containing anesthesia drugs, antibiotics, and other medications. They also contained things like disposable diapers and infant formula. So the helicopters can carry only a fraction of the capacity of a truck, and they are much more expensive. These airlifts are still subject to Israeli regulations, but Jordanian aid officials say they can get medicine into Gaza this way much more reliably and much faster.
Okay, what else did you see?
Well, we took off from an airbase about an hour from Amman and flew along the Dead Sea, then into Israel. In Israel, you can see built-up communities and green fields, and then it's a very stark difference when you cross over into Gaza. From the air, we could see skeletons of buildings hit by Israeli airstrikes and others in rubble. And in the distance, there was that Mediterranean coastline. So, A, we landed just within Israel's buffer zone in Gaza, not far from the city of Darabala. And it was a very rare glimpse of Gaza, even that limited view, because Gaza journalists have been reporting from there at great risk from the start. But Israel, for the most part, bans foreign news organizations from Gaza.
Jane, before we get to President Trump and who he's going to meet this week, I mean, how was it to see everything from the air? I mean, it's one thing to have a ground's eye view, but then to have this overview like you had, what was that like?
It was really surreal because you don't see anything living in that part of it, Deir al-Bala, which has been heavily hit. I mean, really, it from what we were seeing, it was just rubble. And it's important to note that Israel prevented us, according to the Jordanian authorities, from taking photographs on the ground of what we were seeing. The only thing we could take photos of once we landed were the buffer zone and the helicopter. But to actually see it real in real life was really unreal.
Yeah. Now, President Trump last week announced that he wanted to relocate Palestinians in Gaza to Jordan, Egypt. Jordan's King Abdullah is arriving in the United States for talks with President Trump tomorrow. How are those talks expected to go?
Those are going to be tough. That coveted coastline that Trump officials have their eye on is Palestinian territory, and Jordan sees the plan as an existential threat. So Jordan is a key ally and security partner, and it's made clear it would see Israel trying to relocate more Palestinians here as a breach of their peace treaty and a declaration of war.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Amman. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
Back here in the U.S., courts plan multiple hearings this week on challenges to President Trump's bid to reshape the federal government. The hearings follow up on temporary court orders.
Yeah, judges blocked the laying off of staff of the Foreign Aid Agency and from offering long-term leave as an enticement for workers to quit. Another judge told Elon Musk to stop rooting around in sensitive Treasury Department records. In response, though, Republicans have attacked some of the court orders as unfair.
The cases share some common themes. They accuse the president of failing to execute the laws or overstepping his power. So what are the laws that keep landing the White House in court? Our colleague Steve Inskeep got one critical assessment.
That assessment comes from David Super, who teaches at Georgetown Law School here in Washington. When we talked, we kept having exchanges like this. Is that legal?
Not at all.
That's what he said about the offer for workers to quit, and this is what he said of making it easier to fire civil servants. Was that legal?
No, it wasn't.
In fact, Super has a view of almost all the administration's early moves to reorganize the government. Are any of them strictly within the confines of the law?
None of the high-profile ones.
He says some actions could have been done within the law, but the administration didn't follow the process. Some lawsuits contend the president violated the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. It passed soon after the death of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. His administration had expanded the government's reach into people's lives, which led to demands that when the government changes the rules, it should act carefully and fairly and transparently.
So we came together on a bipartisan basis and passed the Administrative Procedure Act, which is designed to make agencies use their powers in public and to seek public comment on them.
There's a phrase in this law, as I understand it, that gets quoted a lot these days, arbitrary and capricious. The government cannot do things in a way that is arbitrary and capricious. What does that mean?
There have to be reasons for things that are done, permissible reasons. It's fine if I decide that your business should be suspended because you're selling dangerous foods, but it's not fine if I say your business should be suspended because I don't like you.
In President Trump's first term, he ended DACA, the legal status for people brought to the U.S. as children. Chief Justice John Roberts said Trump failed to give proper reasons.
If your reason makes no sense or makes no effort to figure out what the facts of the situation are, then that may be found arbitrary and capricious.
Isn't it true that President Biden also ran afoul of this during his term?
Yes, every president who has served since 1946 at one point or another has run up against the arbitrary and capricious standard.
Now this standard is part of a lawsuit objecting to the sudden virtual shutdown of the U.S. Agency for International Development.
The very essence of it is that the administration has declared that they don't like AID and hasn't given good reasons.
I'm thinking about things that various figures of the administration have said, and they're contradictory. Elon Musk, who is a leading figure here, has shared conspiracy theories about USAID. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, says, in fact, he's in favor of a lot of foreign aid, but a lot of it is not in U.S. interests.
There are a lot of functions of USAID that are going to continue, that are going to be part of American foreign policy, but it has to be aligned with American foreign policy.
Inconsistent statements are another mark of being arbitrary and capricious. In the first Trump administration, Chief Justice Roberts struck down another action of the administration because they kept changing their rationales, and ultimately he felt that they were being disingenuous.
David Super also finds a problem in the proposal for federal workers that a court considers today. The administration claims people could quit now and get months of paid administrative leave.
Federal law limits paid administrative leave to 2 weeks in any calendar year, so that'll run out long before September.
Another question is whether the president can shut down federal functions or whole agencies mandated by law. Doing that is called impoundment, and it's governed by the Impoundment Control Act of 1974.
The Impoundment Control Act was enacted after President Nixon withheld money from a great many domestic programs that he didn't agree with. He was sued for violating the laws setting up those programs. He lost every single one of those cases that the courts decided on the merits, including 9-0 in the Supreme Court.
During the same era as those court cases, Congress set up a process for the president to ask Congress not to spend money. That is the Impoundment Control Act. But in a confirmation hearing this year, the president's budget director, Russ Vogt, told Senator Patty Murray that Trump doesn't believe in that law.
The president ran on the notion that the Impoundment Control Act is unconstitutional. I agree with that. I would, in response to both questions, say that what the president has unveiled already are not impoundments. They are programmatic
delays. Has the impoundment
delays.
Law ever been said to be unconstitutional by a court of law?
Not to my knowledge.
It has not. So it is the law of the land. I don't care what the president said when he was running. It is the law of the land.
David Super, the law professor, heard that exchange and notes an irony.
If the Impoundment Control Act was struck down, the president would have even less power.
Take away that law, and you still have a unanimous Supreme Court ruling that the president must spend as Congress directs, according to the Constitution. David Super offered assessments of other administration moves. He questions the move to dismiss workers because of their perceived political views.
Federal law says that for most government employees, those in the so-called competitive civil service who are hired on their merits, they cannot be discriminated against because of perceptions about their politics.
When presidential aide Stephen Miller claimed, I don't know from what evidence, that 98% of USAID workers were leftists,
overwhelmingly, the career federal service in this country is far left, left-wing.
Is that evidence of an illegal purpose?
It absolutely is.
Some people may be listening to all of these details and find them rather complicated and boring. Like, who cares if there's a public comment period or if there's a proper waiting period before you fire your inspectors general, or who cares if you give the reasons, we like Trump, we know what the reasons are, or we're just not that interested. Is this stuff interesting to you?
It is, because this goes to the basic question about whether we have laws in our country that mean anything. If this goes forward, then this president and any president in the future can largely do whatever they want, and we cease to be a country of laws.
David Super, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
He is at Georgetown Law School and has one assessment of the laws governing the administration's early actions. We can expect to hear the administration's response in court hearings this week.
And just a note, the earlier clip of Stephen Miller was from CNN. This is NPR News.
the next Fresh Air, Questlove returns. He'll talk about the life and legacy of Sly Stone. His new documentary, Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, premieres soon on Hulu. Questlove won the Oscar for another of his music documentaries, Summer of Soul. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Arm, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to Christopher Miller, author of Chip War, about how tech is helping to shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump's threats to seize Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark, have put the Danish capital of Copenhagen on edge. The government of Denmark, a longtime ally of the United States, has insisted Greenland is not for sale. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
The first reaction in Danish political circles to Trump's musings about making Greenland part of the United States was like that of political circles in Washington. Utter confusion.
I think like most Danes, I was like shocked.
Elisabeth Svane, a political analyst for one of Denmark's most important newspapers, says Danish officials suddenly became hyper aware of the minute details, like when Trump happened to mention his Greenland takeover plan.
There was a big relief when he didn't mention Greenland in his inauguration speech.
But then Trump called Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen, and Svane says after the 45-minute conversation, Frederiksen looked rattled. It was clear Trump was serious about his plan. But why?
And the guesses range from because he's uninformed, to it's a way of negotiating, to he's actually going to do it.
Rasmus Jarlov is the Conservative Party spokesperson on Greenland and chair of the Defense Committee in Denmark's parliament.
There's nothing that the United States could want in Greenland that they couldn't get just by talking to us, normally, without threats of annexation.
He says if Trump wants Greenland's vast mineral resources, he's welcome to mine them. If it's shipping lanes he wants, he says there's nothing standing in the way. And if taking Greenland is to help better secure the region against Russia and China, Jarlov wonders why the U.S. only has 150 troops at its military base on Greenland, down considerably from 15,000 troops which it had in the early stages of the Cold War. If you want to send more troops to your base there, President Trump, says Jarlov, go ahead. He says none of the reasons the Trump administration is putting forth for taking Greenland make sense when Denmark has been peacefully managing the island for 600 years.
Denmark is big enough to have Greenland, to control it, to keep the Chinese and Russians out, but we're small enough that they don't feel threatened by us.
Whatever the reason President Trump wants Greenland, political insiders conclude he's ushering in a new age of American imperialism.
So MAGA is now about really, literally making America greater in terms of size.
Christine Neeson is an analyst at the Danish think tank Europa. She says Danes have always welcomed U.S. military presence in Europe to ensure defense against adversaries like Russia. But nobody ever thought the U.S. would become an adversary.
It has disrupted the Danish and the European worldview in a way, because for Denmark, appeasing the U.S. has been the number one goal for Danish foreign policy, security policy for the last couple of decades.
Neeson says Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen's response to Trump, she's publicly said that this issue is one for Greenland to decide, is what she calls a timid response. But it underscores the thorny relationship between Greenland and Denmark.
There's an election coming up, and we are very likely to see sort of a new structure of the Danish-Greenlandic relationship in the future.
Neeson says most Danes don't think about Greenland too much. In the past 2 weeks, she's noticed Danish media personalities apologize for mispronouncing Greenlandic names because the press here barely covers the island. At a rally in front of Copenhagen's City Hall to celebrate a championship for the Danish men's handball team, Daniel Giallo, who's waving a red and white Danish flag, says he's never been to Greenland, But if Trump wants to buy it, then it's not up to Denmark.
If the people from Greenland wants to sell, if that's what they want, they should do it. I don't think the Danish people should decide. The people from Greenland, they should decide, is Denmark or American?
Greenland's election is scheduled for next month. In a recent poll, only 6% of the island's residents said they're in favor of becoming part of the U.S. And last week, Greenland's parliament outlawed foreign donations to political parties, a sign that the people of Greenland would prefer to remain autonomous. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Copenhagen.
Hey, A.
Yeah.
I have some dental news.
Okay.
Scientists have figured out how to grow human-like teeth.
Ooh, that's cool.
In pigs.
Oh. Say that again.
Yes. Scientists have figured out how to grow human teeth in living pigs.
Okay. Please tell me boar.
Okay, well, I don't know about that, but I'm going to let Pamela Jelic tell you. She's a professor at the School of Dental Medicine at Tufts University.
Pig jaws are very similar to human jaws. So the pig is a nice model to use for looking at tooth development.
How are they similar?
Jelic says pigs have multiple sets of teeth, just like humans. But unlike humans, pigs regrow them throughout their lifetime.
So, you know, we have baby teeth and then adult teeth. So humans have two sets of teeth. Pigs have 5, 6, depending on the strain of pig.
She says if scientists can understand how pigs regrow and replace teeth so many times, they might be able to regrow teeth in people.
Ooh, all right. So what did her team do?
Well, first you have to understand that your teeth are living.
And the reason is because the middle of the tooth contains soft tissue that has cells in it. And it also has blood vessels and nerves, and it's living, it's vital.
Jelic and her team took that soft living tissue from both human and pig teeth, combined them in a lab, and then transplanted it into pigs' mouths.
In a few months, you can get a pretty good sized bioengineered tooth. Now, it's not perfect, it's not perfectly shaped or sized, but closely resembles a natural tooth.
So in their experiment, they were able to take that tooth grown into the pig and then put it in a person?
No, not at this stage, no. So the idea, Jelic says, is to study how teeth grow and then try to figure out how to replicate that process in people. She says this research could help improve how we repair and replace our teeth so that they are stronger and last longer.
When you think of a tooth crown or a dental implant, some of the methods that have been used have been around for 100 years. Time to get some better tooth substitutes out there.
Yeah, I gotta imagine it's gonna take a few more years at least before this technology finds its way in our mouths.
Right, although Jelic says it's still an exciting time.
There are a lot of advances that have been made which are accelerating this whole process. So it will happen. It will happen. I hope in my lifetime.
Which, you know, should put a smile on our faces. Some people's. Maybe mine. This is NPR News.
There may be little that President Trump and his former national security advisor agree on these days, but one thing could be expanding into Greenland.
There's a lot of distraction in the atmosphere about Greenland and how to deal with it, but these are national security issues of critical importance.
I'm Juana Summers. My talk with John Bolton on Greenland's future on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Trump administration is ordering the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to stop nearly all of its work. Employees and contractors have been told to work remotely this week. The agency was created after the 2007-2008 financial crisis. The directive follows similar efforts by the White House to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development. President Trump says he'll announce a new 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports today. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
The president said these steel and aluminum tariffs will apply to everybody, even neighboring Canada and Mexico. Trump also said he'll be announcing reciprocal tariffs on other items that would apply to countries that impose duties on U.S. goods.
Very simply, it's if they charge us, we charge them.
He said he plans to roll out details at a news conference later this week.
But if they are charging us 130% and we're charging them nothing, it's not going to stay that way.
Trump also told reporters that no foreign company should have a majority stake in U.S. steel. But he did encourage Japan's Nippon Steel to make an investment in the revered American company. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 162 points, the Nasdaq up 235. This is NPR. A judge in New Hampshire has granted an injunction blocking President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship. This is the third judge to strike down the move aimed at deterring migration. The decision comes after two similar rulings by judges in Seattle and Maryland last week. A lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union contends that Trump's order violates the Constitution and attempts to upend one of the most fundamental American constitutional values. Thousands of Eagles fans flooded the streets in Philadelphia last night to celebrate the team's 40-22 win over the Kansas City Chiefs in Super Bowl 59. Quarterback Jalen Hurts, who was named Most Valuable Player, led the Birds to their second Super Bowl win in 7 years.
It's been a long journey. It's been a journey of ups and downs and highs and lows, and I've always stayed true to it in the end, and having this vision of just being the best that I can be.
Next up is the Super Bowl parade, which is expected to be held in Philly later this week. Stocks on Wall Street are trading higher across the board at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 176 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 231. The S&P up 41 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The Kansas City Chiefs did not make history yesterday. In last night's Super Bowl, the Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles, denied KC the chance to become the first team to win three straight Super Bowls. Instead, the Eagles dominated the game from start to finish and won 40-22. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now to talk more about the game. I thought it was going to be a close game, Becky. Vegas thought so, too. They only had the Chiefs favored by a point and a half. I mean, it didn't turn out that way at all.
Absolutely not. And I'll own that I was one who also thought it was going to be a close game. But I think you could definitely put this one, A, in the pantheon of bad Super Bowls. It was fully over by halftime. The Chiefs were shut out in the first half, and more than that, they managed only one first down, only 23 yards of offense in the whole half. And so put another way, they allowed more points in the first half than they notched yards, so because it was 24-0. It's really just a disaster for the quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, for the Chiefs. Two backbreaking interceptions in that first half that both led directly to Eagles touchdowns. After the second one, you could see the Chiefs' best defensive player, the lineman Chris Jones, fall to his knees on the sideline, which said it all. Just too much to overcome, and of course, as you say, ended up losing.
And in all phases, the Eagles look fantastic.
They did, absolutely. I mean, yes, obviously credit to their defense. We just talked about how bad the Chiefs' offense looked. That's on the Eagles' defense. And then their quarterback, Jalen Hurts, was named Super Bowl Most Valuable Player. He deserved it 100%, absolutely terrific. This was a guy who has had plenty of doubters during his time in Philadelphia, but credit where credit is due, he has played just absolutely terrific games in both Super Bowl appearances he has made with the Eagles, the other one, of course, being the first Chiefs-Eagles matchup back in 2023, which the Eagles lost. Last night, the Chiefs' defense seemed to have made this bet, you know, like, can we put everything into stopping running back Saquon Barkley? And if we do that, can Jalen Hurts make the plays that the Eagles will need to win? And the answer, Hurts said, was an emphatic yes. He threw for 221 yards, rushed for another 72, and had three total touchdowns. Here's Eagles head coach Nick Sirianni singing his praises after the game.
He had an unbelievable game today when we needed him to, because when you sell out to stop one thing, another thing opens. And Jalen was able to take advantage of that today. And him and this team are world champs forever.
Becky, is it a surprise that the NFL is still the only of the big four North American sports leagues that has not had a three-time consecutive champ in the Super Bowl era?
You know, I think both yes and no. I mean, yes, because we had gotten so used to Patrick Mahomes doing Patrick Mahomes things that I think there was this, like, across football analysis leading up to the game these past 2 weeks, it was like, look, the Eagles have X and Y and Z advantages, but the Chiefs have Mahomes, so we're picking the Chiefs because we're not going to pick against him while he keeps doing all this stuff. But if we're being honest with ourselves, I think for most of this season, the Chiefs did not look like a three-peat contender. They had escaped close game after close game, seemingly could have lost many more than the one game they lost with their starters this season. Obviously, it's hard to get to a Super Bowl, let alone three in a row, so credit for that, but their luck ran out last night.
Sure did, yeah, sure did. Now, this dings maybe the legacy of Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs a little, but what about the Eagles?
I mean, I think they've consistently been one of the great teams of the last decade. Their last Super Bowl win back in 2018 came over Tom Brady and the Patriots, sandwiched in between two Patriots Super Bowl wins. Now, this one denying the Chiefs their three-peat, both times denying the loss what otherwise could have been a three consecutive run by the two most successful franchises of modern NFL history, which is definitely something I'd be proud of were I a Philadelphia fan.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thanks.
You're welcome.
Ukrainians keep track of the war with Russia. There's an app for air raid alerts, social media channels that monitor missiles or drones Russia launches, and as peace negotiations may be coming, Ukrainians are glued to a homegrown map of the shifting front line. NPR's Joanna Kakissa spoke to the creators in Kyiv.
Every day in Ukraine, there's a 24-hour news marathon that includes the latest on battlefield movements. Here's an anchor from the OnePlus One TV station. And she's citing an open-access map that gets millions of views and aims to show the shifting front line without sugarcoating. The map is called Deep State, somewhat ironically, and it was created by two childhood friends. One is 30-year-old Ruslan Makula.
We try to show the situation as realistically as possible, because no matter what, you cannot hide lies.
We meet Makula and the other Deep State founder, 25-year-old Roman Pogorili, at their office in Kyiv. Pogorili shows us banners of Ukrainian military battalions and a mini museum of weaponry that includes destroyed Russian drones.
It's like a trophy that the Ukrainian army takes.
Pogorili was a law student and Mikula was working in marketing when they started Deep State about 4 years ago as a Telegram channel focused on foreign affairs. Back then, Pogorili says, the channel had only a couple hundred subscribers.
It was our friends, our families, so.
When Russian troops built up along the Ukrainian border in late 2021, the channel's focus turned exclusively to the impending war. Pogorili says they used open-source intelligence to create the map.
We tracked how the troops were moving through photos and videos we verified. We thought it would be useful, and it was.
They use multiple videos and photos posted online by Ukrainians and Russians to verify authenticity. The map shows Russian-occupied land shaded in red and land held by Ukraine in green. Troop movements are marked by arrows. Small red squares pinpoint Russian units and bases. Mikula says some Ukrainians used the map to evacuate after the invasion.
They fled based on where the Russians were. So they tried to avoid the territories that were marked red, and this saved lives.
They say a Russian soldier even used deep state to surrender. The map gives instructions on what to do when a Russian IP address is detected. Pahorili lists many others who now use the map, including frontline farmers, volunteers shuttling supplies to towns under siege, and even the Ukrainian military. He says the map has hidden functions that only verified soldiers can use.
I won't go into details of how they use it, but I will say it helps with orientation and planning and situational awareness so they understand what's happening on the ground.
Mikula says they sometimes delay adding details that could compromise Ukrainian military security, but they refuse to present a map that does not correspond with the reality on the ground.
Because we are fighting a war and our institutions must have maximum trust. We tell everyone that if you lose trust, you lose everything.
The map is funded by donations, and the company has grown to include 100 paid employees and volunteers. Yet Pohorili and Mikula say they yearn for a day when their map is no longer needed here, when the war ends and all occupied territories are shaded green for victory, something that feels more uncertain than ever. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News. The Netflix movie Emilia Perez got 13 Oscar nominations, but the streaming service also makes not great movies meant for distracted viewers. Perhaps by design. Next time, here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, Martinez. Valentine's Day is Friday, and while I'm sure you have gift ideas for your current boo, what about your ex? Enter the Anchorage Bird Treatment and Learning Center, where for just a $10 donation, they will name a mealworm after your ex and feed it to a magpie or crow. For $100, they'll use a rat and feed it to a falcon or an owl. The center will take a video of the bird eating your ex's namesake and will give it to you to do with whatever you like. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Jarl and Pamela Lamone, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau ground to a halt over the weekend.
Under President Biden, the agency issued and enforced rules to cap overdraft fees and to remove medical bills from credit reports. Now employees have been told to stay home this week.
NPR personal finance correspondent Laurel Wamsley has been following this. So Laurel, if the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau cannot do its work, what does that mean for Americans?
Well, it's quite troubling because the Bureau is the country's consumer finance watchdog, and it's an enforcement agency. I've talked with several CFPB staff and former staff in recent days, and they named a few big concerns. One is that a new stop work order from its new acting director halts the agency's supervision work. They said the agency has hundreds and hundreds of employees who go across the country, who go into companies and make sure they're following important consumer protections. As Julie Margetta Morgan, who is CFPB's Associate Director of Research and Monitoring, till she left the agency last month, put it.
They're shutting down literally the cops on the beat.
They make sure your student loan company is actually processing your payments and that mortgage companies follow the rules put in place after the Great Recession. And there's a second big concern, which is that all of this is happening under Elon Musk, who is the CEO of Tesla and has talked about wanting his X company to be a whole commerce and payments platform. And now it looks like he has access to all of CFPB's records, including companies' proprietary information. That'd be a huge competitive advantage to someone like Musk. And of course, there are worries that that sensitive information will be mishandled.
I mean, it's been a mile a minute with news out of the CFPB. What's the latest?
Yeah, it's been a tumultuous few days. On Friday, staff from Elon Musk's government efficiency team were seen at CFPB headquarters, and they've gained access to those key internal systems. Then over the weekend, Trump tapped Russell Vogt as the new acting director. Vogt was an architect of the conservative policy agenda, Project 2025, and he sent an all-staff email ordering a halt to virtually all of their work. Shortly thereafter, Vogt posted on X that he would not be drawing the agency's next round of funding from the Federal Reserve. And then just yesterday, an email was sent to all staff and contractors saying that CFPB's DC headquarters would be closed for the week and that they have to work remotely.
All of this kind of sounds like what we've been seeing happening with USAID.
Totally. It appears to be the same playbook. Yeah. I mean, both are independent agencies that this current administration appears to be trying to dismantle. Republicans have targeted the Consumer Protection Agency for years, though. They've often accused its regulators of overreach. And then on Friday, Musk tweeted, CFPB RIP.
Yeah, I saw that tweet. All right, so what happens now?
Well, staffers are just bracing themselves for whatever comes next. One told me that they went to the DC headquarters yesterday just to grab some personal items before the building closed for the week, and they weren't allowed in. And, you know, at USAID, the vast majority of staff were put on administrative leave before a federal judge put a hold on that. And last night, CFPB's union filed a lawsuit against Vogt, the agency's new head. In terms of that funding being slashed at CFPB, we actually saw the same thing happen during Trump's first term, but then later on they went back to taking the money. And the thing is that if this whole thing is being done for government efficiency, CFPB isn't really where you'd start. It has a relatively small budget, and since its launch in 2011, it's delivered more than $20 billion back to Americans.
That's NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Yeah.
tariffs and prices in general.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. Our team is watching for confirmation the administration will raise tariffs on steel and aluminum by another 25% today. Canada, Mexico, and Brazil sell the most steel to the U.S., Canada the most aluminum. This comes on top of a general economic environment where there's a lot of money washing through the economy. To take today's economic pulse, let's turn to Lauren Seidel-Baker, an economist at the New Hampshire-based economics consultancy firm ITR Economics. She's been tracking this.
Absolutely. Tariffs at the end of the day are inflationary. We've seen so much messaging from this administration about tariffs being punitive or to encourage domestic production. But at the end of the day, what this does is it raises prices, whether that's raising prices on foreign imports or giving domestic producers a little bit of leeway to raise their own prices. We saw that effect during the first Trump administration.
Now, among other things, this can percolate into the price we pay to borrow.
Absolutely. And we at ITR Economics do expect resurgent inflation by the second half of this year, really due to non-tariff, non-Trump policies. And so I see these tariffs and some other administration goals, which will be largely inflationary, kind of as an outside risk.
So you're saying that if you set aside Trump administration policies, there's still some inflationary trends.
Exactly. A lot of our leading indicators do show that activity is picking up. So whenever we get just more demand, that's going to be more pull on prices, demand side pull on prices. But more generally, our government has pushed a lot of liquidity out into the marketplace that does tend to be inflationary. So where the Fed saw inflation get away from them one time already, they really don't want that to happen again. That's why I think we're looking at about as low as we'll see interest rates trend this cycle. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if by the end of 2025, we even start to hear about interest rate hikes on the horizon.
Taking the economic pulse today from Lauren Seidel-Baker. She's an economist at the New Hampshire-based ITR Economics. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Dow is up 134 points, 0.3% now. The S&P is up 0.7%. The NASDAQ is up 1.2%. The 10-year interest rate down today, 4.47%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Rubrik. When cyber attacks come for the cloud and threaten business operations, Rubrik gives you the power to bounce back fast. More at Rubrik.com. And by Baird. Baird strives to attract and retain top financial talent, providing stability and continuity for clients. More at BairdDifference.com.
Led this program with the state of jobs. Now a report of a different kind from our unusual job series. We call it What's That Like? The largest single employer of musicians in this country is the military.
I'm Staff Sergeant Justice McKenzie, and I'm one of six music arrangers for the United States Air Force bands. I started my career as a performer. My primary instrument is tuba. I've always been something of a contrarian. And when I was deciding which instrument to play, this was fourth grade for me, no one else had picked the tuba. In fact, it wasn't even present at the, we call it instrument petting zoo, where you get to try out all the different instruments. And they told me that there's actually one other instrument that isn't here. It's called the tuba. And I thought to myself, well, if it's not here, probably no one else is picking it, and that would make me special. So I got my start in fourth grade. I spent several years as a touring musician, but I was really looking for more stability in terms of lifestyle and in paycheck. I saw the Air Force bands had a vacancy and they were hosting an audition to fill it. And that seemed like the perfect opportunity to have a more stable career. After auditioning, I realized the gig was actually so much more than just stability. It's actually the perfect way to serve my country with my greatest talent and continue to pursue my passion for music. This is one of my favorite memories of my career so far. I had the opportunity to play keyboards in our rock band. And following the withdrawal from Afghanistan, a lot of Afghan refugees wound up in a processing camp at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico. Our rock band was sent out there to perform for them and also for all of the American troops who had been deployed to Holloman to take care of them. It was just really funny performing for the refugees because all of our go-to music, like the stuff that really hits, you know, we had Van Halen and Stevie Wonder and Tina Turner and Whitney Houston, and none of it landed with them. So, you know, here's me playing under a tent in 30 degree weather, trying to get this audience to clap along to Living on a Prayer or something. And they were like, they're just not having it. But after our set, one of the Afghans who happened to be a musician came up to the stage with like a guitar. And all of a sudden it was like Woodstock. And we did our best to kind of learn their songs by ear. And all of a sudden we've bridged this huge cultural gap. And we're making connections with people who are about to be assimilated into American culture. So I decided to apply for the position of a music arranger. My job here involves all kinds of musical decisions as I restructure and expand original compositions while still trying to preserve its essence. In that sense, this is both a technical and creative role. It requires a really strong foundation in music theory and orchestration, and the ability to imagine how a piece is going to sound before it's performed. We perform music, and therefore I arrange music, as broad as the American culture itself.
Next one's probably like the most current one we do. We hope you like it.
Our rock band just got back from a long tour overseas, and I know right now they're pretty tired of performing Espresso, but it's one of the most popular songs, so it's on our set list. In an ever more connected world, every country matters and all of our partners matter, and the Air Force bands have been a really important tool of soft power, of diplomacy. What we're representing is American airmen and their professionalism, and we can't put an F-16 on every street corner and show the American public what amazing pilots we have and what amazing maintainers we have and what amazing ammo troops we have. But we can host a band concert in a medium that they understand and say, if you think what you're hearing is great, you can rest assured knowing there are hundreds of thousands of American airmen who are doing their job with the same level of professionalism.
That was Staff Sergeant Justice McKenzie. Jobs Unusual, if that's you, tell us about it by emailing morningreport@marketplace.org. I'm David Brancaccio. From APM, American Public Media.